Welcome to a continuing series of messages surveying books of the Bible. Our speaker is Dr. Ken Boa, president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today's study is on the book of Daniel. Here's Dr. Ken Boa.
Welcome to the Talk Through the Bible Visual Bible Overview Series. Today we're going to survey the book of Daniel to give you a better feel for the contents of the book as you begin to study it. Looking at the Old Testament from a chronological standpoint, there are three major types of books: historical, poetical, and prophetical. But chronologically, Daniel supplements the 11 Old Testament books that move the storyline of the Old Testament forward in time. From this skeleton of the historical books, the poetical and the prophetical books hang. For our purposes today, we will be looking at the book of Daniel, which takes place during Israel's exile in Babylon. Let's begin with an introduction to Daniel and to its title. Daniel's life and ministry bridged the entire 70-year period of Babylonian captivity. Deported to Babylon at the age of 16 and handpicked for government service, Daniel becomes God's prophetic mouthpiece to the Gentile and Jewish world, declaring God's present and eternal purpose. 9 of the 12 chapters in his book revolve around dreams, including God-given visions involving trees, animals, beasts, and images. In both his personal adventures and prophetic visions, Daniel shows God's guidance, intervention, and power in the affairs of men. The name Daniel or Daniel means God is my judge. And the book is, of course, named after the author and principal character. The Greek form Daniel in the Septuagint is the basis for the Latin and English titles. Let's have a look at the authorship of the book of Daniel. Daniel and his three friends were evidently born into noble Judean families and were young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking and gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, 1:4. As part of the re-identification process, he was given a new name that honored one of the Babylonian deities. Belteshazzar meant Bel protect his life, see 1:7 and 4:8, as well as Jeremiah 51:44. Daniel's wisdom and divinely given interpretive abilities brought him into a position of prominence, especially in the courts of Nebuchadnezzar and Darius. He is one of the few well-known Bible characters about whom nothing negative is ever written. His life was characterized by faith, prayer, courage, consistency, and lack of compromise. This greatly beloved man, 9:23, 10:11, and 19, was mentioned three times by his 6th century BC contemporary Ezekiel as an example of righteousness. Daniel claimed to write this book, 12:4, and he used the autobiographical first person from chapter 7, verse 2 onward. The Jewish Talmud agrees with this testimony, and Christ attributed a quote from Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, to Daniel the prophet, Matthew 24:15. Turning our attention to Daniel's date and setting, Babylon rebelled against the Assyrian Empire in 626 BC and overthrew the Assyrian capital of Nineveh in 612 BC. Babylon became the master of the Middle East when it defeated the Egyptian armies in 605 BC. Daniel was among those taken captive to Babylon that year, when Nebuchadnezzar subdued Jerusalem. He ministered for the full duration of the Babylonian captivity as a prophet and a government official, and continued on after Babylon was overcome by the Medes and the Persians in 539 BC. His prophetic ministry was directed to the Gentile courts of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, and Persia, Darius and Cyrus, as well as to his Jewish countrymen. Zerubbabel led a return of the Jews to Jerusalem in the first year of Cyrus, and Daniel lived and ministered at least until the third year of Cyrus, 536 BC, chapter 10, verse 1. Daniel's book was no doubt written by Cyrus's ninth year, about 530 BC. As he predicted, the Persian Empire continued until Alexander the Great, 11:2-3, who stretched the Greek Empire as far east as India. The Romans later displaced the Greeks as rulers of the Middle East. For various reasons, many critics have argued that Daniel is a fraudulent book that was written in the time of the Maccabees in the 2nd century BC, not the 6th century BC, as it claims. But their arguments are not compelling. First, the prophetic argument holds that Daniel could not have made such accurate predictions. It must be a prophecy after the events. Chapter 11 alone contains over 100 specific prophecies of historical events that literally came true. The author, the critics say, must have lived at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, 175-163 BC, and probably wrote this to strengthen the faith of the Jews. But this argument was developed out of a theological bias that assumes true prophecy cannot take place. It also implies that the work was intentionally deceptive. Second, the linguistic argument claims that the book uses a late Aramaic in chapters 2-7, and that the Persian and Greek words also point to a late date. But recent discoveries show that Daniel's Aramaic is actually a form of the early Imperial Aramaic. Daniel's use of some Persian words is no argument for a late date, since he continued living in the Persian period under Cyrus. The only Greek words are names of musical instruments in chapter 3, and this comes as no surprise, since there were Greek mercenaries in the Assyrian and Babylonian armies. Far more Greek words would be expected if the book were written in the 2nd century BC. Third, the historical argument asserts that Daniel's historical blunders argue for a late date. But recent evidence has demonstrated the historical accuracy of Daniel. Inscriptions found at Haran show that Belshazzar reigned in Babylon while his father Nabonidus was fighting the invading Persians. And Darius the Mede, 531-61, has been identified as Gabur, a governor appointed by Cyrus. Now that we've covered some background, let's move deeper into the book of Daniel itself. Daniel, the Apocalypse of the Old Testament, presents a surprisingly detailed and comprehensive sweep of prophetic history. After an introductory chapter in Hebrew, Daniel switches to Aramaic in chapters 2-7 to describe the future course of the Gentile world powers. Then in chapters 8-12, Daniel reverts back to his native language to survey the future of the Jewish nation under Gentile dominion. The theme of God's sovereign control in the affairs of world history clearly emerges and provides comfort to the future church as well as to the Jews whose nation was destroyed by the Babylonians. The Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, and Romans will come and go, but God will establish his kingdom through his redeemed people forever. Daniel's three divisions are, first, the personal history of Daniel, chapter 1. Second, the prophetic plan for the Gentiles, chapters 2-7. And third, the prophetic plan for Israel, chapters 8-12. The personal history of Daniel, chapter 1. This chapter introduces the book by giving the background and preparation of the prophet. Daniel is deported along with other promising youths and placed in an intensive training program in Nebuchadnezzar's court. Their names and diets are changed so that they will lose their Jewish identification, but Daniel's resolve to remain faithful to the Lord is rewarded. He and his friends are granted wisdom and knowledge. The prophetic plan for the Gentiles, chapters 2 to 7. Only Daniel can relate and interpret Nebuchadnezzar's disturbing dream of the great statue, chapter 2. God empowers Daniel to foretell the way in which he will sovereignly raise and depose four Gentile empires. The Messiah's kingdom will end the times of the Gentiles. Because of his position revealed in the dream, Nebuchadnezzar erects a golden image and demands that all bow to it, chapter 3. The persecution and preservation of Daniel's friends in the fiery furnace again illustrates the power of God. After Nebuchadnezzar refuses to respond to the warning of his vision of the tree, in chapter 4, he is humbled until he acknowledges the supremacy of God and the foolishness of his pride. The Feast of Belshazzar marks the end of the Babylonian kingdom, chapter 5. Belshazzar is judged because of his arrogant defiance of God. In the reign of Darius, a plot against Daniel backfires when he is divinely delivered in the den of lions, chapter 6. Daniel's courageous faith is rewarded, and Darius learns a lesson about the might of the God of Israel. The vision of the four beasts in chapter 7 supplements the four-part statue vision of chapter 2 in its portrayal of the Babylonian, Persian, Greek, and Roman empires. But once again, the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, 7:18. The prophetic plan for Israel, chapters 8 to 12. The focus in chapter 8 narrows to a vision of the ram and goat that shows Israel under the Medo-Persian and Grecian empires. Alexander the Great is the big horn, 821, and Antiochus Epiphanes is the little horn, 823. After Daniel's prayer of confession for his people, he is privileged to receive the revelation of the 70 weeks, including the Messiah's atoning death, chapter 9. This gives the chronology of God's perfect plan for the redemption and deliverance of his people. Following is a great vision that gives amazing details of Israel's future history, chapters 10 and 11. Chapter 11 chronicles the coming kings of Persia and Greece, the wars between the Ptolemies of Egypt and the Seleucids of Syria, and the persecution led by Antiochus. God's people will be saved out of tribulation and resurrected, chapter 12. The topics move from Daniel's background in chapter 1 to Daniel interpreting others' dreams in the next 7 chapters, to the angel interpreting Daniel's dreams in the remainder of the book. The language begins in Hebrew, changes to Aramaic in chapters 2 to 7, and then reverts back to Hebrew for the rest of the book. The place is Babylonia and Persia, around 605 to 536 BC. Let's look next at the theme and purpose of Daniel. Daniel was written to encourage the exiled Jews by revealing God's sovereign program for Israel during and after the period of Gentile domination. The times of the Gentiles began with the Babylonian captivity, and Israel would suffer under Gentile powers for many years. But this period is not permanent, and a time will come when God will establish the Messianic kingdom, which will last forever. Daniel repeatedly emphasizes the sovereignty and power of God over human affairs. The Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses, 4:25. The God who directs the forces of history has not deserted his people. They must continue to trust in him because his promises of preservation and ultimate restoration are as sure as the coming of the Messiah. Now we'll turn our attention to a few keys to understanding Daniel. The key word for Daniel is God's plan for Israel. One of the two key verses in Daniel reflecting this key word is found in chapter 2. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are His, and He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with Him." 2:20-22. The second key verse is also found in chapter 2. "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." 2:44. Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks, chapter 9, 24-27, provides the chronological frame for messianic prediction from the time of Daniel to the establishment of the kingdom on earth. It is clear that the first 69 weeks were fulfilled at Christ's first coming. Some scholars affirm that the last week has not yet been fulfilled because Christ relates its main events to His second coming, Matthew 24, 6 and 15. Others perceive these words of Christ as applying to the Roman desecration of the temple in AD 70. As we consider some of the contributions of Daniel to the Bible, while Ezekiel emphasizes the nation's religious restoration, Daniel concentrates on its political restoration. Daniel was clearly a prophet, but he did not occupy the prophetic office by making public proclamations to the people as God's representative, like Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Therefore, this book was placed in the writings, the third division of the Hebrew Bible, rather than the prophets. Because it is apocalyptic literature, Daniel has many similarities to Revelation, particularly in its imagery and symbolism. Some believe that it was fulfilled before or during the first century AD, but others believe that portions await fulfillment. The second view argues that since the events of the 69 weeks were literally fulfilled in the four kingdoms, the events of the 70th week will be literally fulfilled in the future. Now let's look at ways in which Christ is portrayed in Daniel. Christ is the great stone who will crush the kingdoms of this world. 2:34-35, 44. The Son of Man, who is given dominion by the Ancient of Days. 7:13-14. And the coming Messiah, who will be cut off. 9:25-26. It is likely that Daniel's vision, chapter 10, 5-9, was an appearance of Christ. Compare Revelation 1:12-16. The vision of the 69 weeks, 9:25-26, pinpoints the coming of the Messiah. The decree, 9:25, took place on March 4, 444 B.C., Nehemiah 2:1-8. The 69 weeks of 7 years equals 483 years, or 173,880 days, using 360-day prophetic years. This leads to March 29, AD 33, the date of the triumphal entry. This is checked by noting that 444 BC to AD 33 is 476 years, and 476 times 365.24219 days per year equals 173,855 days. Adding 25 for the difference between March 4 and March 29 gives 173,880 days. And finally, in our overview of the book of Daniel, we'll consider three applications. Our first application revolves around the ironic idea that God uses weakness for His glory. Four exiled teenage boys were given a supernatural understanding by God, not for their glory, but for God's glory. These were not experienced, powerful, tested older men that had seen God work for decades as adults. These four boys may be the youngest positive examples in the Bible and youngest examples of surviving the severe trial of the 900-mile Trail of Tears from Jerusalem to Babylon after Nebuchadnezzar's destruction of Jerusalem and its temple. These four lads were handpicked by the Babylonians as the very best and brightest of Israel's royalty, and as privileged slaves were indoctrinated for 3 years in the language, literature, paganism, and customs of the Babylonians. They were placed among the magicians of Babylon and faced tremendous spiritual warfare as their lives were to be destroyed because of Nebuchadnezzar's anger that none of the wise men or magicians of Babylon could determine and interpret his dream. That is, all of them except Daniel. We find God deliberately choosing the weak, such as Moses, as his spokesperson to Pharaoh in spite of his stutter, or in pairing Gideon's army of 32,000 down to a paltry 300 soldiers, or God using a shepherd boy, completely untrained in battle, against the fierce giant warrior Goliath. And in the New Testament, we see God choosing to use ignorant fishermen as the core to spread his good news around the world. The Apostle Paul, arguably the greatest man outside of the Gospels, had this to say about his thorn in the flesh that God deliberately gave to him. "And he has said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me.'" 2 Corinthians 12:9. Therefore, whatever your weakness, however powerless or inadequate you feel, know that God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. 1 Peter 5:5. Never underestimate how God can use weakness in your life and the lives of others, including teenagers. His power is perfected in weakness. Our next application flows from Daniel's life in general, rather than from one particular chapter. Daniel was a great example of lay ministry. Daniel was part of Israel's royalty and demonstrated his leadership capability both under the Babylonian Empire and the Persian Empire. He was a wise, skilled ruler, able to earn the confidence and trust of his captors. But he also had the spiritual gift of dream interpretation and was a man of habitual prayer, as well as a prophet. The entire second half of the book of Daniel unfolds a very complex geopolitical prophecy from Daniel's time all the way to the end of human history when God sets up his own kingdom. The point is, Daniel was not a priest. He and his friends were from the royal family, not the tribe of Levi, which was a requirement of the priesthood. And though the term layman or lay ministry does not occur in the scriptures, it is a helpful distinction. As a non-priest or lay person, Daniel was certainly God's chosen representative to Nebuchadnezzar, and an excellent representative at that. As for application today, note that the priesthood of Aaron or the Aaronic priesthood lasted temporarily for the 1400-year period between the time of Moses at Mount Sinai and Christ being crucified on the cross at Golgotha. Before and after that time period, each man was his own priest. This is also known as the priesthood of the believer. Each believer is free to represent himself to God and to represent God to others. As such, believers function in their role as God's priests. In fact, in the New Testament's Hall of Faith, we find no Levitical priests or rabbis mentioned. Levites came from Joseph's brother, Levi, so none existed until that time. Thus, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Sarah all lived before the time of priests. Joseph was not from the tribe of Levi. However, Moses was a Levite, but the Levitical priesthood began through his brother Aaron, as we noted earlier. Rahab was from Jericho and not from the tribe of Levi. Gideon was from the tribe of Manasseh. Samson was from the tribe of Dan, Judges 13:2. Jephthah was from the tribe of Manasseh, Judges 11:1. And David was from the tribe of Judah, Ruth 4:18. None of these great men and women of faith were priests. They were lay people, not professional clergy. But today, each person has the right and responsibility to be his own priest, as 1 Peter teaches, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. 1 Peter 2:9. Thus, every believer has the right and responsibility to be a priest of God. We are his full-time representatives. We are no more part-time representatives of Jesus than we are part-time members of our earthly family. Priesthood is part of every believer's identity in Christ. As such, we should not expect the paid professionals such as our pastor, priest, or church staff to do all the work of ministry. Their job is to equip the so-called lay people for the work of ministry. The question is, how good a priest or representative are you? What do you need to do to take your personal ministry to the next level? And if you don't yet have any ministry, ask yourself if you are willing to pray for a mentor to help equip you for ministry. What skills or information or development do you need to improve your ability to minister to others? Give this thoughtful consideration in prayer, perhaps discussing the matter with your pastor or elders. Our final application consists of three options that God exercises as our deliverer from the book of Daniel. First, God may deliver us completely from the trial we're going through. For example, Daniel 1 relates that Daniel and his friends were delivered from Nebuchadnezzar's decree of execution because none of the Babylonian wise men or magicians could tell and interpret his dream. God did not make Daniel and his friends go through any part of the Babylonian execution process. They were spared from the experience altogether. When God delivers from a trial, we will not have to endure the trial. God will either remove the trial or remove us from the trial. As such, we will survive the trial. As a second option, God may choose to deliver us through the trial. For example, in Daniel 3, God made Daniel's friends go through the process of being thrown in the furnace, but miraculously saved their lives. Similarly, in Daniel 6, God did not spare Daniel the anxiety of death by being eaten alive by wild lions, but miraculously shut the mouths of the lions. He was not delivered from going to the lion's den, but he was delivered through the near-death experience. This was also true of God delivering Israel from the Egyptians by making them cross the Red Sea while he miraculously parted it as they crossed and then closing it upon the Egyptian army. When God delivers through a trial, we will indeed have to endure the trial and not be spared from it. However, in spite of the fact that we will have to go through it, we will survive it. The third option is being delivered by the trial into Jesus' arms. Neither the book of Daniel nor the rest of the Bible records the events of Daniel's death, but whether by old age or sickness, God chose not to deliver him from that trial, unlike Enoch. Nor did God choose to deliver Daniel through the trial, but rather God delivered him into his loving, strong, and wise arms by ending his earthly sojourn. This is the case, too, of the martyrs recorded in Hebrews 11 who experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword, Hebrews 11:36-37. When God delivers by a trial, we will indeed have to endure the trial, and we will not survive it. However, by this trial, we will be delivered into Jesus' arms. So God may deliver us from, through, or by our trials. But according to the Apostle Paul, even the third option is not a bad one. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain, Philippians 1:21. Paul viewed his death, in which God delivered him into his arms through beheading, as positive, not only because Paul knew his Lord, but also because of his knowledge of heaven, about which he told the Corinthian church, things which eye has not seen, and ear has not heard, and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him. 1 Corinthians 2:9. As finite creatures, our human minds are incapable of imagining or grasping the wonders of heaven. God promises us that heaven will be like nothing we've ever seen or heard of or ever imagined. Our destiny with our loving Father, whom we will then behold face to face, will truly be an experience beyond words or imagination.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.